lot of people, they're listening to this and they're like, okay, we're extending the growing season. We're getting more food. Like, that's a great thing, right? Like, we should be celebrating this. But really, there are negative impacts that are happening. Candace Jordan here with the Carolina Weather Group. I've got on my different hat today, but we are at my work location, the Scheel Museum of Natural History. We're out here on the farm. It's a little misty out when we're recording this, but all good. And I've got my good friend here, Nathan Chapman.
Oh, hey, Nathan. Thank you. Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I brought him along because we're going to talk about a really, really important topic here. And the reason I picked him to come help me talk about this is because we're going to talk about the relationship of plants and climate. And Nathan here is one of our program educators, and he specifically focuses a lot on our outdoor things. So tell us a little bit about your background first.
So I've been an avid gardener since I could walk, basically. So always out in the garden exploring, eating things that I maybe or maybe shouldn't eat from time to time, out in nature. I did eventually go to NC State University, get a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Science and Plant Biology. So know way too much about what's going on inside of a plant. No, too much. But generally, that interest and that passion carried over into agriculture, gardening, and then just wanting to be able to share that. So that's kind of like my background.
Yeah. So when I asked Nathan if he wanted to come talk to me about plants and climate, and I was like, yo, can you talk for at least a few minutes about this? And he was like, no problem.
No problem.
Got this.
Hours could be spent.
Right. So for those of you at home, I don't know if you've noticed this over the years, but you may have noticed that certain plants are blooming a little earlier. You plant them a little earlier. They're getting a little later in the year. What you always expect is kind of shifting and changing a little bit, right?
Definitely.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So the largest shift has been that our spring frosts have moved back in time, so you can grow things like summer vegetables earlier, and our fall frosts have moved back also, so you can actually grow things later in the year than you normally would. So there's benefits and trade-offs with both of these, but we'll kind of get into the details of that in a moment.
Yeah, so what are some of the like broad impacts of the climate crisis on agriculture? We've kind of heard this about climate crisis, you know, with temperatures globally that are increasing. You know, we're seeing more natural weather events that are borderline, you know, not so great for the environment. So tell us a little bit about how that's kind of impacting agriculture.
The largest thing is that our normal weather patterns, normal temperatures, normal rainfall amounts, everything's kind of becoming more extreme. So if we're going to have a drought during the summer, it's going to be longer and drier. If we're going to have a flood in the winter, it's going to be much more rainfall, and our temperatures can swing much more dramatically, even more than they normally would in North Carolina. So, you know, December is pretty, it's getting fairly common to have 70 degree days, which even from my childhood is rare, like non-existent up till just a few years ago. So mainly extreme temperatures, and these weather extremes impact our agriculture through drought, which we've kind of already kind of discussed, like plants have to have water to be able to grow. Heat waves and also these extreme weather events can impact livestock. So cattle, for example, like in our large pastures, they can only survive certain temperatures. So if it gets very, very hot and very humid, it is very detrimental to their health and can result in their death. And that is becoming, unfortunately, more and more common. And that goes for all of our livestock. Pests, disease, all of the stress of this heat, this cold, these fluctuating temperatures leads plants to be more stressed, so more prone to diseases, more prone to pests. And even for kind of like on the human side of things, like agricultural workers who have to go out and work, it is also very hazardous and dangerous to their health, like either from extreme temperature or from wet bulb events where our bodies basically just cannot cool ourselves. It's too hot and too humid.
Yeah, we talk a lot as meteorologists, we talk about the heat index. You know, and so that's taking into account what the temperature is and also what it feels like. You know, your body can kind of perceive humidity. And so when it's nice and dry outside, you know, you can feel the heat. But when you have a layer of humidity on top of that, It's like the air you can wear, you know, it's just sweltering outside. Now, one thing I want to touch on, because I know you said this, you said that the plants get stressed and you know, they're more prone to diseases and such. Is that kind of similar to humans? I know when humans get stressed, we get tired, you know, we're mentally spent, like, you know, a lot of kind of side effects can happen when you're overstressed chronically. Right. So is that similar to plants?
Exactly the same. So pretty much all organisms that are alive, so animals, plants, mushrooms, even germs, even if they encounter stressful situations or areas that are not beneficial or good for them, they can have a really hard time of just maintaining themselves, kind of like we, kind of like people. Right. If we're really stressed, it's really hard to maintain ourselves. And it's also, we're a lot much more susceptible to diseases and things of that nature. So plants, the exact same way.
Right. So I know there's this thing, it's from USDA, it's called like the hardiness zone map. What is that? Like, what does it tell us? You know, why do we care about this map?
Right. So the USDA hardiness zone map is basically a map of the entire United States and territories. And it basically is a guide to what you can grow. Here in Gastonia, Charlotte area, we're zone 8A. So it basically says it gets too cold on average over the wintertime for you to grow pineapples, bananas, kind of like tropical fruits.
Right.
And it's also an indicator of what plants you cannot grow due to summer temperatures. So you can kind of extrapolate. Like, we can't grow cranberries here anymore. We used to be able to just a few years ago, but we can't anymore just due to the high heat levels during the summer months. Other plants, rhubarb, cauliflower, and broccoli are even having a harder time in this climate due to those kind of like shift in temperatures.
Not being able to grow something or being able to grow something now, kind of on both spectrums, that's not only a local thing. Like, this is like a worldwide economy now with food.
Yes.
So are we seeing differences even now starting?
Yes. So in general, this will kind of help. It might be a tangent, but
a good tangent. We love tangents.
So most of our food plants that we can think of, like when you think of a food like potatoes, rice, tomatoes, anything like that, most plants stop growing at temperatures above 86 degrees. They go from, you know, growing happy, we're going to make lots of food, to we're just surviving. So they basically sit in the ground, conserve resources, make all kind of basically proteins that help protect themselves in drought, and they're not focused on growth. So that is like 86% of the food crops that we eat. So if it gets above 86%, 86 degrees Fahrenheit outside in the summertime, most plants you see stop growing and they're just sitting waiting for it to cool off. There are a few plants that can handle higher temperatures, and this is restricted to corn, sorghum, and millet. The one that we mainly care about here in our area is corn, and it can handle temperatures up to 95 degrees, but above 95 degrees, it even stops growing. So it just sits there. So when it's a 100 degree day, the plants outside just stop.
They stop.
And above that, you've only got things like pineapple, agave, and certain cactus that can handle the crazy extreme temperature.
Yeah.
So, trying to get back to the question. basically, all of our growing areas are going to have to either start like adopting plants from further south, or if you're in southern hemisphere, kind of thing closer to the equator, adopting those plant species to grow farther north. And then our cold weather plants that we love and depend on, like wheat, all of our cabbage things, cabbages and things like that, all of those crops are going to gradually start growing and moving northward. So like our grain belt, that's in the Midwest, can slowly, maybe even with this in this century, if we're not addressing the problem, could move up into Canada potentially. So devastating impacts that it's just going to take a lot of cooperation on human and country's scale of like working together so we can, you know, have food and kind of accommodate our needs.
So this hardiness map, I mean, it's literally showing kind of these different zones. How often is it updated? Because it would be really neat to see, you know, even like you're saying, even in your lifetime, you've noticed that like cranberries aren't a thing around here anymore. You know, like how often does that map get updated? And can we see the trends over time?
So I don't believe that there's a set update time. I believe it's as needed. I believe there was an update in 89. one in 2012, and those largely stayed the same from 89 to 2012. From 2012 to 2024, 12 years, most, over half of the U.S. has shifted 5 to 10 degrees. Like, the cold, average cold winter temperature has shifted 5 to 10 degrees warmer in 10 years. And this region would normally get down to, like, 5 degrees, but now our average is only getting down to 10. And if that holds, we'll be similar to, like, central to mid, central to lower Georgia within a few decades, which is kind of concerning.
Well, I mean, even, you know, we were working on an event in February, and jokingly, we were like, man, I hope it's one of those, like, 70-degree February days. But, like, when you think about it, you know, decades ago, you really wouldn't sit there and be like, oh, you know, there's a good chance maybe we can get that 70-degree February day. So, you know, you're seeing these climate change, you know, happening, and it's not only impacting human health. I feel like that's all we hear a lot of. Rightfully so. I feel like to get humans involved in helping to repair the climate, you have to make it human-centric. But plants are definitely involved, too. Back with more, Carol.
Have you ever seen what an indoor environmental assessment looks like in a commercial building or business? During a full assessment, we collect data throughout the building and compare the measurements room to room. We can also collect samples that go to a lab, such as the small cassette shown here, which will be analyzed for types and amounts of mold in the air. We follow up with a physical inspection, looking for moisture sources and using moisture meters to determine if any of your building materials are wet.
Go-ESG.com or 336-373-153. Extended conversation in just a moment, but first to our question. When can you start gardening safely in the Carolinas? Well, as we've been talking about, that date's getting a little bit earlier and earlier each year, but let's look at this data from the North Carolina Climate Office. Most of the Carolinas is in green, so that really puts us at about tax day, somewhere between April 8th, April 15th, maybe as late as April 22nd. That date obviously gets later into May, almost June in some places, as you make your way to the higher elevations of the western North Carolina mountains, and earlier as you make your way to the coast, where it'll be a little bit warmer, a little bit earlier, and so you might be able to start planting some of those hardier plants by the end of March. This is a look at the latest date in which we can anticipate seeing a 32-degree freeze in North Carolina. What about South Carolina? I don't have a map, but I have a chart. So just to kind of look at some of these numbers here real briefly for you, again, we're zeroing in right now on the 32-degree threshold of most likely having that last hard freeze. Aiken, March 22nd. Anderson, March 19th. And so this is those dates where you can expect the temperature will hit 32 degrees for the last time that winter as we head into the growing season. Charleston, that date is more like February 13th. So you can certainly start a little bit earlier there along the coast. Chester, in the greater Charlotte area, you have to wait more to March 21st, maybe even to the end of March. Our friend, Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich at WCNC Charlotte, he really emphasizes wait until tax day, wait until we get into April. In Columbia, that date, again, could be as early as February 26th, but as we've seen just in the past week or so, we still have the possibility of some really cold at or below freezing mornings in portions of the Carolinas, even during the month of March. So you have to watch that very carefully. Lawrence, 32 degrees last date, about March 27th, give or take. Newberry, that date is more like March 20th. Orangeburg, March 2nd. So there's a widespread, of course, because the climate and the weather is so different across the Carolinas. We have both of these resources linked for you right now in the description of this show, wherever you are watching or listening. Let's get back out now to the Scheele Museum.
Some like strategies that maybe farmers or gardeners can do to kind of approach this head on.
So the largest thing is kind of anticipate. So if you're accustomed to, you know, a cold snap, anticipate a stronger or a harder cold snap, or maybe later or earlier. It's very hard to predict weather patterns. But kind of have an infrastructure in place to kind of like protect against that. So one example would be like if you anticipate a drought during the summer, like have some way of some ready access to water. So either ponds if you're like larger scale, or even rain barrel if you're like a smaller home gardener, or like mulching your plants very heavy to conserve as much water that does fall, so the water stays where it needs to be, right? And that's largely kind of like some things that we can, like on the home scale, that we can kind of think about. Other strategies to be would be just to be kind of aware of where our food comes from. Kind of like not saying go out and change everything that you do, because we're finite creatures in a basically infinite world. But kind of pick and choose things that you'd like to improve on, diet-wise or whatever, and kind of, you know, pick the best option if you are able to do so.
What's the most surprising plant change that you've noticed? Or, you know, since the newest update, like, you know, what's something that's just really shocking to you in the Carolina area?
So peach trees are a fairly good indicator. It's like one of our first fruit trees to bloom. Currently we have some blooming out on the farm, and it's slowly been incrementing back, like maybe just on average maybe a day or 2 days, but now we're moved up to maybe even like almost a full month earlier than we would normally anticipate. Jonicles are another really good indicator. Jonicles are buttercups, nasturtiums, things of that nature.
So are there plants that, you know, you're saying like the peach trees and stuff, are there plants that kind of alert you to, like, or signal you that, hey, something's kind of amiss with the climate?
I mean, definitely so. So, I mean, just looking at any tree, pretty much, they're slowly waking up earlier and earlier every year. Even plants that we don't expect to even, like, leaf out until late April or even into May are now leafing out in mid-April. So things like black walnut and pecan are normally very late leafing out, but they're slowly working their way back to make the most of all the warm, fair weather and maybe grow bumper extra crops. But they're just trying to do their thing, trying to make it through.
So one question I have, you know, we have these kind of extended growing seasons. Does that have any impact on the soil health? Because now the soil, especially like with farmers and gardeners, you know, the soil is being used longer. Does that impact the soil health?
So it's largely management strategies. So if you have a good kind of like soil health practice, it can be an improvement. So you have more time to grow plants that can feed the soil. You can get more crop rotations out. You can actually get more food out of your systems. But if you have a kind of like soil destructive, kind of like productive, it can increase and exacerbate kind of like the damage. So the damage that would take several years to show up could show up in maybe 1 to 2 years. So it really comes down to management. It's a double-edged sword.
Right. Because, you know, to a lot of people, they're listening to this and they're like, okay, we're extending the growing season. We're getting more food. Like, that's a great thing, right? Like, we should be celebrating this. But really there are negative impacts that are happening.
Right, definitely. And we may have longer growing seasons in general, but the instability of like when that first fall frost is going to hit can have a significant impact. Like if you're trying to squeeze out another tomato crop or another cucumber crop, it can completely devastate it just due to the instability. So it's very unpredictable right now.
So another question I have, you know, you're looking at your fruits and vegetables, and you know, the ones you get in the store, I feel like they're always a little bit different than what you grow, you know, on the home turf there. Are there any changes that you're noticing with, like, for example, like tomato size or water content in them do kind of like over the years?
Right. So generally, like, produce from the supermarket is under heavily controlled, like, production measures. Like, lettuce is normally grown in greenhouses under very set parameters. So haven't really noticed too many shifts in that department. Generally, your grocery store products have been bred to have really good shelf life, hold their water and the color very well, maybe not hold the best flavor. But your home crops are definitely going to have some kind of like struggles, like more pest pressure, earlier pest pressure when you're not necessarily expecting it, diseases and all types of detriments just related to the shift.
Yeah, so not even talking about just plants, but yeah, the pests that go along with the plants are coming out earlier and they're staying later.
Yes.
Has that been an issue?
Yes. So one notable kind of like problem insect is the squash vine borer. So it's kind of like a little grub that comes from a day flying moth. So it has steadily been emerging earlier and earlier, and its favorite food is squash, zucchini, and pumpkins. So we used to be able to get a nice full crop of squash and zucchini before it would show up. So you plant the seeds, no pesticides or anything needed to get a good harvest. But now it's showing up earlier and earlier, and it's kind of eating into that first summer, like soft summer squash and zucchini crop. And it's also been a very large detriment to like pumpkin crop as well. So
I know like we're like gung-ho for spring, you know, it's
definitely
spring. But like looking ahead to fall, have we noticed that pumpkins are we getting them earlier and earlier?
So we're trying to. So pumpkins, fortunately for pumpkins, you can kind of, you have a little bit of wiggle room. So, and this longer growing season enables that even more. So normally you'd plant pumpkins May through June, like late May till the 1st of July is the ideal time. So it's not really impacting the early pumpkins as much, maybe increasing it maybe like a week or so at max currently. But it is lengthening the length of the pumpkin season. It might be marginal, only like 1 to 2 weeks, but it is kind of lengthening.
All right. So I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Okay.
All right. Give me your favorite plant fact.
Oh, no.
He gets to educate lots of people each day. And I know he's got like a wealth of knowledge up here. So we're going to impart a little bit to you guys today. So what's your favorite plant fact?
So my current favorite plant fact has to go back to plants and when they shut down at certain temperatures. So all different types of plants have special adaptions to different climates where they come from. And most of our food crops really come from Europe, which is a cool climate. And most of those plants are C3 plants. So yeah, way too complicated, but basically they like cool, wet, and not too hot.
Just we are not.
No. So we're slowly losing the ability to grow these types of plants over time. Still able to do it, have to plant them earlier and earlier every year. But my favorite kind of like fact related to it is cam plants. So this is your pineapples, agave, cacti, things that grow in the middle of the desert. They photosynthesize, so they get their energy from the sun during the day. They have all their stomata, which is our plant mouths that let plants breathe, get air, breathe out water. They have all those shut, so they just catch energy during the day. And then at night, they grow and breathe. So they basically collect energy during the day and then go through, live, and do all their things at night, where most plants are breathing, living, growing all at the same time.
All right. Thank you, Nate, for being here today. We've learned a lot about plants and climate and the relationship between it all, and how it's all interconnected within humans and plants, the pests, the food industry, your local backyard gardens. Basically, you can't just rely on what you've always done, because even like the weather, it's changing.
Yes,
definitely. All right, that's all we have for our Carolina Weather Group for today. So I am Candace Jordan here at the Scheele Museum with Nathan Chapman.
Thank you.
Have a great night.